Medical information obtained from our website or the live show is not intended to be a substitute for professional care. If your pet has or you suspect they might have an illness or other medical condition, you should consult a health care provider. The opinions expressed on this radio program are not necessarily those of All Paws Pet Talk, this radio show, or their sponsors.
Hello, you're listening to Smart Animal Talk on All Paws Pet Talk Radio. With me, your host, as always, Deborah Wolf, deborahwolfonline.com if you're looking to find more of me. And, I've got a litter coming. You all know that if you're a regular of the show. You know it's about 10, 14 days away until my litter comes. So keep checking back. We'll have pictures posted of those new puppies. And you know what's really strange I find about puppies? Kittens. Baby pigs, at a certain stage, like one day old, they all kind of look the same. A little bit like human babies, actually. But you're never supposed to say that. So anyway, they're very, very, very cute, and they get cuter and more dog-like every day. So tune in for that. Today, we have a veterinarian coming with us, joining us. And if you want to ask your question, you can call 1-888-627-6008. Why not? Especially... And this is unusual. We don't usually say this, especially if your question has to do with your pet that is not a dog, not a cat, but a bird. We're going to be going a little birdie today with Dr. Hess. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hess.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I've never talked with you before, so I'm really curious. Do you have a practice that deals with pet birds?
I do. It's actually pet birds and exotic animals in general. So it's called the Veterinary Center for Birds and Exotics. We're in Bedford Hills, New York, which is Westchester County. And we not only deal with birds, but we deal with rabbits, all kinds of rodents like guinea pigs and chinchillas and hamsters and gerbils and rats and mice, ferrets, all kinds of reptiles, amphibians, and then some less commonly known animals like sugar gliders or hedgehogs or wallabies. All kinds of fun exotic pets.
Like a mini tiny zoo, it sounds.
Yeah, sort of. They're all pets, so they're not zoo animals, but it's definitely a little different from your average cat and dog hospital.
Okay, well, how is it different? I mean, most of my listeners, they have a dog, they have a cat. Maybe they, growing up, knew somebody with a ferret or a parrot or something. But most of us don't have that sense of knowing how to connect when we meet one. How's it different? Are these truly pets?
Yes, they're definitely pets. They're all domesticated. I mean, we see all kinds of things. I mean, as I mentioned, all these different species. But most people, as you said, don't even think about, many of them think about having them, purchasing them from a pet store or a breeder, but not necessarily taking them to an animal hospital to take care of them. And most of these animals have very specific requirements, so it's even more important than it would be for a cat or a dog, who, most people know that they need to be walked or fed or whatever. These animals have very specific requirements. So what I try to do is to teach people how to take care of them and remind them that they need to come back annually for regular checkups like you would with a cat or a dog.
There's some weird stuff, right? Like teeth that don't stop growing and nails that don't stop growing and odd. Well, give us some of the ideas here.
What's really interesting is
a normal cat or dog owner having maybe received one of these exotics for a pet might not really know and inadvertently, and really neglect their pet seriously because they just had no idea this needed to be done.
Well, I mean, the main thing, the basic thing is that many of these species, like birds and some of the reptiles, turtles, some of the lizards, they can live decades. So I have patients who are in their 60s, and people don't realize that the same changes go on in these animals' bodies, like arthritis or atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries, heart disease, kidney disease. The same changes go on in these animals' bodies that go on in our bodies as they age. And so we need to stay ahead of those problems and give them good checkups and medications so that they don't suffer from really serious illnesses that could be prevented if they just came in for regular checkups. So that's the biggest challenge I face is getting to see these pets before they're really sick and showing signs. You know, many of these animals are prey species, so they hide their illness really, really well until they're very, very sick. Otherwise, they would get eaten by the predator in the wild if they lived in the wild. So we don't want to wait for them to get sick. We want to catch the illness early or prevent it altogether by checking them regularly.
You know, when I'm talking to people about dogs and cats, I often tell them you should touch your dog every day on every part of them if you can, or at least do one dog today and one dog tomorrow, so that if they have a tick or a lump or something, you're going to notice it before it's too late. Because otherwise, I mean, you know, 4 feet away, you're looking down at your dog, he's kind of hairy. You don't necessarily notice that there's a massive mat under his underarm that's now ripped apart and become an oozy sore and is infected or whatever. You don't notice these things unless you touch them. What about with exotics? Are they supposed to be touching their pets in between
Absolutely.
The annual visit?
Yes, absolutely. I encourage people to touch their pets. Unfortunately, it's even a bigger problem than it is with cats or dogs. A lot of people don't touch their pets. Some people have birds that they look at every day, and maybe the bird stands on their finger, but they don't really touch them and touch their back and under their wings and all around. They might not notice something. Certainly a lot of these pets, even with birds or other animals, they may not be eating, or they normally drop a lot of their food, so it looks like they're eating, but they're not ingesting a lot. And maybe they're all feathers, and you wouldn't really know unless you weighed them that they were not really eating enough and that they were losing weight over time. So it's a really big problem for exotic animal and bird owners to know when their pets are sick until they're really, really sick, unfortunately. And sometimes I can't help them at that point. And that's why it's important for them to bring them in so that I can touch them all around and check them and make sure things are okay.
Okay, touch them all around, though. I think there are people listening, especially with birds, who are thinking easier said than done. Right? I mean, I've tried. I've been at that stage where someone says, well, he likes some people, and I go to reach to touch him, and he goes to pretend attack me, and I can tell it's a pretend, but I'm not comfortable enough with birds the way I am with dogs and cats. So even though I know he's not really attacking me, I get a jolt of fear. Probably he can smell the fear, and I recoil quickly, and now he's really trying to attack me. So I messed up. I don't have a way with birds. You know, I can grab my own chickens and deal with them when I have to, but I'm not a parrot charmer. How do you, someone brings in a bird that doesn't like to be touched, how do you touch it?
Well, it takes time and it takes training. I mean, the great thing about birds and parrots in particular is that they're very smart. So if you use positive reinforcement training the same way you would with a cat or a dog, and you take a favorite food treat, and you're very patient and you're calm, because they definitely sense when you're stressed or fearful, and you teach them very slowly, like, I can touch your foot, and now you get a little treat, or I can touch your back, and now you get a little treat, and you work on this every day, then they come to anticipate that touch brings them something really delicious, and it has to be something that they only get when you're doing that skill with them. So if they love to have, I don't know, a piece of cracker or something like that, they can't be getting crackers all day long. Otherwise, there's no incentive to allow you to do what you want to do or ask them to perform a certain activity in response for a reward like that. So it's just a matter of time and training. And if people do this, not only can they learn to handle their animals, but they can teach them all kinds of phenomenal things, speaking, tricks, stepping up, stepping down, all kinds of things. It makes the whole relationship with that pet, that exotic animal, that bird, really, really wonderful and much more fulfilling for the owner.
I want to ask you about bald spots on birds in a minute. But before we do, I just want to say what you just said about training a bird makes it, you weren't trying to, but you made your point. Your first point about how they are pets. They're not just, beauty objects, objects of art. They really are pets to these people. And the way you described how to train a parrot to let you touch it is identical to how you would train a dog or a cat.
Absolutely
same. And a monkey and a gorilla. Like,
any
I'm
animal.
Just thinking of all the animals I've worked with over the years. That's the first thing you do is, I mean food, I'm okay, I'm safe. And then my touch means food, I'm okay, I'm safe. And then you start teaching them words and concepts. And so where you say something and they give the same reaction, get the reward. And you're building trust the whole time you're doing it. Plus, inadvertently, you don't realize it, but you're getting calmer, because you just touched his foot and he didn't try and peck you or make you bleed. So now you're calmer to touch it the next time, too. So it's like you're training the human at the same time. So when I visit sometimes, I find it alarming. I go to a lot of homes with dogs to do dog training and cats to do cat training. But sometimes there's a bird in the corner of the room somewhere. Often, it seems to me, not close enough to windows. I don't know why. I think they react to things outside and make too much ruckus or something. But But a lot of times, and maybe it's our climate, I don't know, they have missing patches of feathers. And if I say anything about it, like, you know, maybe your bird should see a vet, or have you ever considered why she loses his feathers? And the response is usually, oh, he's fine, it's always like that. That's usually the response. Mm-hmm. And often the people do not know whether their bird is a boy or a girl as well. So I kind of wonder if this has to do with vitamin deficiency, if it's stress, if it's not enough sunlight, if it's all of the above, or if it's a puberty, you know, hormone thing. And they just don't, they don't even know if they've got a boy or a girl. How would they even know what stage this poor bird is in, that it's, because it shouldn't be bald, right?
There shouldn't be. No, it shouldn't be. I mean, if birds are missing feathers, it could be any number of things. So sometimes it's actually a medical problem, and there are some diseases that can be very serious where the feathers just fall out altogether, and that's not normal. There are many, many occasions when birds will feel not well, and they'll pull out their own feathers. And the reasons for that happening can range from anything from a true medical problem to something that they're, you know, some sort of behavior or stress going on. And it could be a stress that no one ever takes this bird out of its cage, and it's bored to death, and it's frustrated because it's sitting in the cage all the time. It could be that it is sexually frustrated because birds are really used to living in big, big flocks and interacting with other birds. And a lot of times these birds bond to their human owners, but they're not mating with their human owners, so they can become sexually frustrated. Sometimes it's just that they don't feel well and they pull out their feathers because they just don't feel well. So it's never normal. And as you pointed out, you know, most species of parrot, you can't tell if it's a boy or a girl. You need a blood test to do that. It's very, very simple. It's a drop of blood, a DNA test. And it can affect, you know, if it's an egg-laying female bird that has an egg stuck inside, well, we want to know if it's a female bird, you know, first off, and we need to do blood work for that. So when you see a bird that's missing feathers, absolutely the first thing that you should do is have that bird checked by a bird-savvy veterinarian to determine, you know, what's going on. It's never normal.
Okay, so that kind of leads to another question of mine I wasn't planning to ask you, but I notice it's a great thing sometimes with veterinary medicine that, you know, you got a dog and it starts to have something wrong with it. You take it into the vet thinking you're just looking at a simple first aid thing. Maybe he's limping, and boom, you discover, oh no, it's cancer. So you need the ultrasound. You need this, that, the other. You might need surgery. You need chemo, maybe. Everything and all that you need is probably available right at your local vet, just like that. You know, if it happened to a human in Canada, it's covered. You don't have to pay for it, but you could be waiting over a year for an MRI. You know, and I notice how these dogs get taken care of and dealt with lickety-split compared to us humans who wait and wait and wait. So in some ways, it's amazing how many things a veterinarian can do. But on the other hand, is it true that there you got to really find the bird vet? For a bird, you got to really find the reptile expert, because I know you take it in school, but it just seems like apples and oranges completely.
You're right. You're absolutely right. In school, you have very, very little training, maybe a week or two of training in most veterinary schools on these species. And that's why I went back to school and did another 3 years just to study bird medicine. And there's an exotic animal medicine. As I said, I see all these species. But there's 125 approximately board-certified bird veterinarians in the world. And I'm luckily, I'm one of them, and I'm very happy about it. It is something that, you know, there are certainly cat and dog veterinarians that are more comfortable with certain fields of medicine. We know that there are, you know, people who just work in dentistry or surgery or ophthalmology, any of those specialties, just like in human medicine. The challenge for me as a bird veterinarian is that I not only have to be all of those things to the birds that I treat, but I have to know about all the species. So I have to know everything from a finch to an ostrich. And although I don't practice on ostriches, it was in my board certification exam, and I have to recertify that test every 10 years. So in answer to your question, there are a lot of great veterinarians out there who are general veterinarians with great knowledge of birds. So for simple things, absolutely, you should just seek out a veterinarian for your bird. If it's something more complicated, hopefully your veterinarian, if he or she is a generalist, will feel comfortable helping you find and referring you to a board-certified avian veterinarian or someone with at least some advanced training in birds. Because we do all those things you mentioned. We do chemotherapy on birds. We do surgery on birds. We do CAT scans and MRIs. But you have to know what you're looking at, and the anatomy is
totally
different.
Oh, it's so small.
Yep, we do all that stuff.
I mean, the scale, like when you think of children who are suffering, the scale is small, and the hospitals have to have smaller instruments and everything. But a finch, Like that's a microsurgery, right?
Yes, it's microsurgery, and it's something you have to pay attention to about, like, blood loss. I mean, you can only lose, like, a drop if you're a vent.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's very important. And my whole hospital was built around the idea that all of our equipment is scaled down to meet the needs of the size of the patients that we work with. So it's different.
Extremely different. You know, it occurs to me there's this number that always comes up. And I don't, you know, when people are deciding, like, say they have a very expensive recommendation from a vet and a problem that they're trying to treat. Well, then the numbers they start to consider are the age of the pet. If the pet is 2 or 3 or 4, they're probably going to do it. If the pet is 13, a dog, they're probably not. You know, there's things like that for a couple of reasons. One is that it's going to die anyway very soon, most likely. But another is it may not be able to handle it. So that's kind of one number that we consider a lot in dog and cat situations is age. But I'm wondering, what about value of the pet? Like I remember this Seinfeld episode where George was dating somebody who hit, I think they hit a squirrel with their car, a wild squirrel, and the squirrel ended up costing him hundreds and hundreds of dollars in vet bills, you know? And so I kind of wonder, like, is this a common, you know, problem with if you paid only a few dollars for a pet or were gifted it and it has no resale value? How does that affect the kinds of treatments that are sought? I mean, cancer treatments on a finch would seem unlikely, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this is a topic that comes up all the time, but there are a few things that I remind people about. One is whether it's a finch or a very, very valuable hyacinth macaw, that animal means a lot to somebody. And so whether they paid for it, you know, they paid $30 for it or, you know, $15,000 for it, it's about the relationship that that person has with their animal. So we spend lots of money on many inanimate objects that don't necessarily give us love back. You know, why would we put a monetary value on the relationship that we have with a little teeny bird if that bird really, really loves us and we can afford it? So that's one thing. And then you think about dogs and cats who have come out of shelters where people have paid nothing for them, yet they're willing to spend thousands of dollars, like, for example, on chemotherapy, because they really love that animal, and that animal brings them great joy. There are some animals that I treat, many animals that I treat, that are inexpensive and easily replaced from the pet store. And then there are other animals, like I mentioned, the hyacinth macaw, that might sell, you know, for $16,000, $20,000. So there is a monetary value, but I think the relationship with the animal that you have as an exotic pet owner, as a bird owner, it can transcend anything. You know, I do also.
Oh, that's so true. And yeah. I wouldn't even, you know, when you think of it in dog terms, is the mutt any right. less valuable than the purebred dog? Not really. I mean, not once you love him, not once he listens well to you and protects you or saves you from a bear, you know, like really, it doesn't matter. And there was a dog just last week who got the Purina award, got a medal and everything for saving a kid, teenager, and his family were tossed from a car and everyone died except this teenager who was brutally wounded. And he ended up in a ditch in freezing cold weather for 40 hours. The dog guarded him and like scared off bears and cougars and you know, I mean, so yeah, and I thought it was a mutt, but it's supposed to be something called a king shepherd, so I'll say maybe on that one. But any which way, who cares what his genetics are when he does something like that? It's about the connection. I understand that. I'm just wondering how often it comes up in your clinic, though. I'm imagining a little more than in the dog and cat.
It definitely does. But remember also, some of the patients that I see live 40, 50 years, so they've been handed down through generations. You can imagine this is really a part of someone's family. It may have belonged to your grandmother and your mother, and now it's your pet. And you can't even imagine that this is like a human being in your family because it's been around for 40 years. So that plays a big part, too.
Okay, so about that, you know, I have a couple of pet peeves when it comes to reptile ownership and exotics, and one of them is that people will not research enough, and they'll believe what the salesman tells them, or the clerk in the store that may not know anything. And so things like, oh, it'll only grow as big as its cage, it will always be this small, things like this. And then they're surprised when they have this animal that if they just asked a vet or read up on it, they would have known was going to become monster size and need rehoming. So there's things like that. How do you tell people where to go? Like if you go online, it's really mixed, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, you really, The best thing you can do is to find somebody knowledgeable in your area, and I do this all the time with people who come and have consultations with me and don't even bring their pet yet because they don't have one, to see if this particular animal is the right fit for their lifestyle. So that includes things like, do they live in a house that can accommodate this pet? Do they travel a lot? How much time do they have to spend? Are they going to be willing to feed, you know, if it's a snake, are they going to be feeding rodents to it? Are they going to be just grossed out by that and not want to do that? So there's so many things that you need to consider, and you also need to consider the financial aspects of having certain kinds of pets. Some animals, the setup, the heat, the light, the thermometers, the everything for it, for some reptiles, is as expensive as the pet. So and it's an ongoing expense because maybe you need to buy a new light each year or new, you know, prey for it to eat. Those are all things you need to consider. And I have had people come in where they think they want one kind of pet and they actually want something completely different because it's a better match for them.
Yes, that's so important. It's like the people who are couch potatoes, but they want a border collie because they read somewhere right. It was smart, you know, and it's like, well, maybe if you find a three-legged one, but otherwise, exactly. This isn't going to work for you people. You know, there's littler or bigger, less energetic, brilliant dogs. Get a toy poodle. They're really, really smart. They won't need yep. The same kind of exercise, you know, so mismatch is a huge cause for getting rid of pets. And I'm sure that's huge, huge in the reptile bird world.
Definitely.
Okay. So you've said a few times how long lived some of these guys are. Is it like, I mean, monkeys are around 50. I think, is it 80 or is it more for these birds? What kind of, I mean, you get a parrot and it's 5 or 10. You kind of have to have in mind who it's going to go to when you die, don't you?
Mm-hmm. You do, and people have to put them in their wills, and they do get passed down from generation to generation. I mean, in the wild, these birds live much longer because they have fresh air and direct sunlight and more appropriate diets. But I do have patients that, you know, live into their 50s, 60s, sometimes longer. And, you know, you need to think about that. If you're a 60-year-old person and you're going to buy a long-lived parrot, well, maybe that's not the best idea, or you need to have a plan for that animal, you know?
So now, okay, so with dogs, and I often recommend to people in that situation that they try fostering. They can have a dog for 6 months or however long before their next snowbird trip away in the winter and not be stuck with it for 10 years, not be restricted in their retirement years by a pet, but still have all the benefits for short term. Is there also, like, say someone really does want a parrot for the next 20 years, can they get a bird that isn't 5 or 10? Can they find one that needs a home?
Definitely. I mean, if you look online, I'm sure you're familiar with websites like Pet Finders.
Where
there's dozens of birds on there, or hundreds of birds on there, and many of them are older birds that people just can't take care of anymore or have given up for various reasons. So absolutely, there are lots of needy middle-aged birds out there. Or you can think about getting, if you get a new bird, get a species that doesn't live 50 years. I mean, parakeets, little budgies, live, you know, on average 6 to 8. Cockatiels live up to around 20. You know, there are many, many species of birds, and certainly the larger parrots live longer, but some of the smaller birds don't, and maybe that's more appropriate for your lifestyle.
Okay, so usually... I must say as a qualifier, I usually only meet naughty pets, right? People don't call me because their dog isn't precision healing, but he's pretty darn good. They don't spend the money to have a private consultation in home unless the dog's pretty atrocious. But a lot of times, the bird is atrocious. And a lot of times, if I go anywhere near it or show any interest at all, people will say, you can have it if you want it. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing these type of birds, these birds that make horrible screeching, squawking noise in the middle of the night or react to things like doorbells and neighbors or have learned really foul language or because I've seen all of this in one bird, actually, can escape and also likes to take like random when he's being all nice with you and everything and sort of rubbing right by his eye and his head against your forearm. All of a sudden, he'll just turn around and nab you. And I mean, you need first aid. So this bird I'm talking about, I'm not good with birds, but he's a big blue and yellow creature, and he's adorable until he's nasty, and then he's adorable again. Okay, so if you're looking for a secondhand bird, how do you deal with this kind of trouble? Because I don't think the really sweet ones are, are as likely to be found, you know?
Well, the thing about birds with behavior problems, and it's, you know, the number one reason that birds are given up to shelters is because of behavior problems, as you said, like screaming and biting and things like that. Those are all fixable things.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, and we were talking about it before. You know, we use positive reinforcement training. Mm-hmm. It's the science of applied behavior analysis. We talk about the ABCs, you know, A being what's going on in the bird's environment, the antecedent of its B, the behavior, and C, the consequence. So if a bird always, you know, if someone asks the bird to come out of its cage and it doesn't want to and it bites your hand and then you leave it alone, it's going to continue to bite your hand because it knows that allows it to stay in its cage. If you give the bird a reason to come out of the cage that's more exciting than biting your hand, like it gets a treat, you can teach the bird to stop biting. So if someone is patient, you know, they can undo these behaviors, but you have to be really willing to work with them. So if you're going to adopt one of those birds with a behavior problem, you have to put the time in. And if you can't put the time in, then it's probably not going to work out for you, right. And it's not beneficial for you or the pet.
What would you recommend if someone's listening to the show and they think they would like, well, let's do birds first and say they're a first-time owner, and then we'll do other exotics. What would you recommend? Maybe they have kids or kids who visit. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been some terrible disasters where people get very dangerous snakes and keep them in cages that don't hold them, and they hurt children. And as cool and menacingly cool as these things are, I think that's really a bad idea. Yeah. What can people do if they want that cool snake or that really cuddly rodent or that beautiful showy bird, but they maybe don't know what they're doing yet?
I think that there are definitely some species that I recommend, and certainly for families with children, that I wouldn't recommend them getting another type of animal. So for birds, I often recommend cockatiels. They are great for children, and they're generally pretty gentle. They do live, you know, up to 20 years, and they are exciting. I mean, parakeets are exciting too, but cockatiels are even more personable in that you can teach them all kinds of songs and how to talk, and they can be handled by school-age children, I should say, and have lots of personality. So, you know, a parakeet or a cockatiel is something appropriate. I would not recommend a big parrot for a family with children because they do get scared by children. They can bite and inflict danger and injury. So, you know, that would be my bird recommendation. For a snake, some of the more common types of snakes that I think are gentle and are fine, again, for school-age children, not younger, would be something like a corn snake or a ball python. They're very small. They don't grow to be big, thick snakes that are 5-6 feet long. You know, they're manageable, and they're gentle in temperament. And as long as a child is supervised, somebody...
Oh, Dr. Hess, we are quickly running out of time, so
okay.
I'm just going to cut to break. And if you wouldn't mind, can you just stay with me? When we come back, we'll talk more. Okay, so stay tuned, everybody. We're bringing Dr. Laurie Hess back, and we're going to be talking more about her safe picks for rodents and birds. Stay tuned to Smart Animal Talk, All Paws Pet Talk Radio. Hey, pet lovers, listen up. Purr Spray Pet, all natural, non-toxic spray for all of your pet problems. Proven safe to use for their skin, eyes, and ears. Helps calm and heal wounds, hot spots, insect bites, and lots more. Will not sting, and very safe to use, even for your feathered friends. To find out how you can keep your pets happy and healthy, go to purrspraypet.com. That's purrspraypet.com. purrspraypet.com. Or call us now at 386-310-3924.
Scratch it.
Is your itchy dog allergy sad? Did you know that our dogs suffer from the same pollen, dust mite, and mold allergies that we do? Now, veterinarian dermatologist Dr. Christian has formulated Doggy Goo. Doggy Goo is a peanut butter treat for your dog. But Doggy Goo also sublingually builds tolerance to 10 pollens, 2 mites, and 3 molds 100% naturally. Try Doggy Goo. Your dog will Doggy Goo look it up. Call 855-246-2426. The number again is 855-246-2426. Or on the web, www.healthygoo.com. Goo spelled G-O-O.
Scratch it. NuVet Plus, your pet's best friend. NuVet Plus is an immune system builder that is safe for all stages of your dog's life. Helps eliminate most issues, including allergies, scratching and itching, hot spots, arthritis and joint issues, chronic ear infections, tear staining, lack of energy, digestive issues, and so much more. All natural, manufactured in an FDA-registered human pharmaceutical lab here in the USA, using ingredients sourced in the USA. Nothing artificial, no sugars, wheat, corn, or dyes. Never heat-treated to help retain all the natural, rich ingredients. Comes with a 60-day money-back guarantee and is only pennies a day. Call us Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific Time. 1-800-474-7044. That's 1-800-474-7044. And tell them you are referred by All Paws Pet Talk Radio. Or go online to www.nuvet.com. That's www.nuvet.com. Use order code 33955. Again, www.nuvet.com. Order code 33955. Put your pet on the path to good health.
For your dogs, running beside your bike is more rewarding canine exercise than any walk. It's also more dangerous. Until now. Introducing the amazingly stable Bike Toe Leash, the only safe dog biking attachment approved by the American Pet Association. The Bike Toe Leash installs in seconds on bikes, trikes, power chairs, and mobility scooters. No tools needed, and dogs learn it immediately. With a Bike Toe Leash, both dogs and rider can enjoy fun recreation anywhere, no matter what your ability level. To learn more and order your Bike Toe Leash, visit BikeToeLeash.com. That's BikeToeLeash.com. Bike toe leashes are made in the USA and ship worldwide. That website again is BikeToweLeash.com.
I'm your doggy.
I'm your doggy.
And I love you.
And I love you.
And you know that
I really
do.
Hello! You're listening to Smart Animal Talk, All Paws Pet Talk Radio, and we do have a guest coming up, Debbie Jacobs, an author and trainer. But before we get to that, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye to Dr. Lori. I won't tease you, making you hang on till next time to hear her recommendations for beginner exotic owners for what they would like in birds and in rodents. We'll do that right now. But we're going to have her back because I have a big long list, like separation anxiety, more on bald spots, got a bunch of questions about birds, the difference between hand-raised and not, all sorts of stuff. And you can send me your questions. You know how. Smart Animal Talk, All Paws Pet Talk Radio. You can send them there. You can send them to DeborahWolfOnline.com, and I will ask the questions for you. Or you can call the show when she's on next. So, okay, Dr. Lori Hess, I have to say goodbye to you. But before I do, could you please tell everybody what you suggest for beginner families who would like a bird? Or, well, the bird was, you said cockatiel,
mm-hmm.
which is not a cockatoo, I believe. There's a
no
difference?
No, cockatiel, little yellow, gray, white bird, not the big white cockatoo.
Okay, so that's a good distinction. And then what about for the snake, you said, I think it was garter?
Well, a corn snake or a ball python. I love corn snakes. Cool. Very gentle.
Nice. And they're what, yellow and orange, are they?
They're yellow and orange and brown. They come in all different kind of patterns. They're beautiful.
Okay, and but that still means feeding them live rodents, right?
Well, or stunned or frozen, or but at least the rodents, yes.
Okay. Oh, God, I don't want that in my freezer. Okay, I am not going to be a snake owner, clearly. All right, and then the last one for the people who want, like, I don't know. I mean, I can't get my head around a pet rat. I see them and I see how well trained they are and how cuddly they are with their owners, and I'm very squeamish about them.
Well, pet rats are great. They only live about 2, maybe 3 years, so they're not right for everybody. The other rodent that I recommend highly, very, very hands down, is the guinea pig. They're wonderful for families, and they live longer and they're hardy.
Okay, so now that's like being sexist or bigoted or something, because I have no problem with guinea pigs and bunnies. I think they're adorable. I will hug them and kiss them and everything. And a rat, I just don't want to. Like, I
Different
really don't
kind
want
of animal,
to. I will if I have
great.
To, but I don't want to.
We'll see what we can do about that. We'll talk about it next time.
Oh, I'm getting therapy from you. Okay, well, next time I'll get some rodent therapy. Thank you, Dr. Hess.
And, thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you'll come back to the show.
I'd love to. Thanks again.
Can you give us the name of your clinic one more time?
Yes, it's Veterinary Center for Birds and Exotics, and our website is www.avian, A, V as in Victor, I, A, N as in Nancy, exotics, with an S on the end, vet.com, avianexoticsvet.com.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Talk to you soon.
Okay. All right, everybody. So we're still here at Smart Animal Talk, All Paws Pet Talk Radio. And our next guest has been standing by. And I believe she has Annie and Nibbles standing by with her. I don't know what that's about, but I heard a lot of shuffling and snuffling and heavy breathing. Maybe there's a pug in the mix. I don't know. Debbie Jacobs, author and trainer, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Yes, little Annie and Nibbles. I was getting them all set up with a stuffed Kong. Hoping that we wouldn't hear from them in the background.
Bribery, and yet I caught on to that. Okay, is one of them a pug? Because one of them snorts.
No, it might have been me.
You? Oh, no, you're a pug? Uh-oh.
Yeah, maybe you heard. Maybe I was snorting. I don't know.
What kind of dogs are Nibbles and Annie?
Well, Annie is a little buff cocker. She's about 10. Nibbles is a little chihuahua mix. I say he's supposed to weigh 13 pounds. He's a little bit over. And then there's also Finn, who's he's settled in. He's a border collie. And then there's Sonny, my about a 55-pound mix, who has been the inspiration for the work that I do.
Well, okay, so Chihuahua was in the mix there. I was just, this never fails. It's constant with me. I drive around in logo car and logoed hat and clothes, and people are just all the time telling me their dog problems. So I went to get gas. It was a full serve, self serve. I was at the self serve. The full serve guy starts heading over to me. He's crossing aisles. I'm like, okay, what is it now? It's got to be a dog problem. Sure enough, he gets to me. He adopted a Chihuahua, a rescue from California, which happens a lot here because there aren't a lot of little dogs here. And it was the rage there after those movies that they got overbred and they're dumped in huge numbers. Mm-hmm. So they kind of export them to different places. But so we get this little Chihuahua dog, and now it just loses it and freaks out, separation anxiety, off the scale. Mm. And he said, you know, my mom's thinking of getting it medicated. And I said, don't. Just call me, email me, talk to me. Don't yet. Let's first try to train it. So is this what you're talking about? Is this what's going on in your house?
Well, actually, I mean, I would have to say to you that I take a different approach than waiting to use medication, especially when the dog is that obviously that challenged. I mean, I don't want to come across as a drug pusher. I'm certainly not. But mm-hmm. when we delay the treatment of a problem that is treatable, we have medication to treat them. It's like, let's say somebody said, you know, my dog has an infection in their foot. Oh, but I'm going to wait to use antibiotic until I see whether or not the body can recover on its own. And by the time they decide, oh, gee, it isn't working, the infection isn't clearing up, well, now the infection is spread, and you go to the vet and say, okay, I'll take those antibiotics now, and the vet says, I'm sorry, we have to cut the foot off now because you waited too long. So I want to be clear. I'm not saying, and drugs are not the cure. They do not, you know, unlike an antibiotic, these drugs that we use to medicate dogs, they're not the cure, but combined with a protocol of behavior modification and lowering the dog's anxiety and stress. And these dogs that you're talking about that are shipped around, that have lost their homes, they've had their lives turned upside down, we don't know where they came from, they probably don't have a solid start in life, these dogs are challenged. Why don't we give them, let's throw everything we can early on, because the problem that occurs when we wait is that a stressed out dog, it's easy to add more problems to the mix.
Well, so there's that example It really makes sense to me because if you think about a human or a human child, because it was a young puppy when it was transported and homeless, if you think about all that animal or child would suffer going through all that at such a developing stage, you can see how the ground was set for anxiety, for nervousness. Also, it's a small dog to begin with, so there's a lot to be afraid of out there in the big bad world as a small dog. So I get how that's compounding things. But I do think sometimes... And in this case, the gas station attendant was telling me, you know, I said, is there going to be a trainer? Because there are veterinarians here who do this with trainers, and they put the dog on some kind of medication for a controlled amount of time along with training with the goal of gradually weaning the dog off the medication. And so that's the kind of thing where I think he would be barking up the right alley. But what he was talking about was just getting the dog on meds, just drugging the dog. And I don't know if before it's been assessed, before they've made any attempts at all at, you know, working on the separation anxiety and the fears and changing the environment. You know, I mean, it's got to be a more broad approach, don't you think?
Well, I mean, definitely. It's at least, as we say, a two-pronged approach. We have very specific training plans for addressing separation anxiety. I can tell you step by step how to treat separation anxiety. It's one of those problems that makes a trainer cringe because it is so challenging, because until the dog is able to be alone, they cannot be alone. It's like taking a little kid who can't swim and saying, well, today I'll play with you in the wading pool, but tomorrow I'm going to chuck you in the deep end because I have to go to work. And hopefully you wouldn't have drowned by the time I come home. So what happens is with separation anxiety specifically, these dogs just get, you know, the process is all mixed up. Now, I'm a trainer. I'm not a vet. I don't say to people, put your dog on drugs. That's not my job. I'm very clear about that. What I advise people to do when I meet a dog who is suffering from a treatable disorder like separation anxiety, like certain fears, anxieties, and phobias, is talk to your vet. Talk to a veterinary behaviorist. Get the information. Your dog could benefit from this. And, you know, the thing about this is that if you try the medication and it helps, people say, oh, you cannot believe it. It makes the job easier. It's like putting the little swimmies on the kid's arm when we're putting him in the pool. It just makes it so much easier for the dog to progress.
It gives you the opportunity, because as everybody knows who's got a healthy, normal dog, training's all about getting your dog used to a habit and making it something comfortable. Like, I'm in the habit of sitting when I hear the word sit, and then I get a treat. I'm in the habit of listening to my mom because she rewards me. I'm in the habit of coming when called because it's always a fun thing. You know, this sort of habit. And so the drugs allow that total breakdown where they're in such fear mode where nothing's getting through. Picture a dog you know that's terrified of thunder in the middle of a thunderstorm. Okay, they're not learning then. They're really not. And when a separation anxiety dog is fully into his anxiety mode, it's very hard to get through. So I could see how the drugs would chill him out long enough for him to get into the habit of 1 minute alone, 2 minutes alone,
exactly.
5 minutes alone. You know, it totally makes sense to me. But I do think that sometimes people are drugging for the wrong reasons. Like, I've been to houses where the dog is always on Prozac or something like it when it's at home, but not when it's here at my boarding kennel. And we're not in the kennel 24/7. They are alone during our breaks and things, but it's the energy, the activity level. This is a Jack Russell owned by people who aren't very active. So sometimes I think it's diagnosed wrong.
Well, the problem is if somebody's using Prozac in that way, they're using it wrong. I mean, Prozac is a long-term medication. You don't put the dog on it for when you need it. It is a long-term medication. So we don't start it and stop it, unlike some of the other medications that are used for situational anxieties and phobias, like storm phobias, thunderstorms, you know, traveling in the car, and even sometimes separation anxiety. There are different medications. So, yeah, for sure, this is true of everything, isn't it? I mean, everybody wants the magic bullet. There is no magic bullet. We know there isn't, but we know that we have the, you know, not only the technology, we have the science to guide us. And so, yes, we definitely need, to do it and, you know, to use both in an educated way, and that's why we do it with the support of a vet, veterinary behaviorist,
and a skilled trainer who can say, yeah, okay, let's give your dog the skill. Like you said, we can give this dog the skill to be home alone for 5 minutes, for 20 minutes, for 1 hour. Being home alone is a skill, and we can train it.
I'm teaching my kids right now, my 12-year-old boy. The first time I left him alone, it was for about an hour. And he had a neighbor at home, and he had a number he could call, and there was someone at the kennel. The second time, it was a little longer. We don't just leave kids for overnight all of a sudden, do we? Right?
It makes sense.
He has to learn how to deal with this. It is a skill. But I think sometimes it's worth looking at what the dog is doing. So I'm going to just give a few examples, and maybe you can also tell our audience what you think about this. But to me, when I look at a dog, I come to a house and they say, I think we're gonna have to drug this dog. He's got OCD. He's out of control. Okay. Now, that may be true. He may be picking his own fur off, but he may have flea allergy. But again, he may be OCD, maybe. He may be tail chasing repeatedly and picking at himself that way. Maybe that's OCD. Maybe he just has no other tricks and no other games. Maybe. And maybe he is a little too competitive and too into his sport, but he needs a better sport. Maybe. Sometimes he's fence running. Now, fence running to me is an extreme sport. So maybe he needs to go for a jog more every day at a time he can count on. Maybe the fence running will stop if he does. Real digging, same thing. If he's digging like mad, that's Stairmaster. He just needs more exercise. Chances are. Now, of course, if you give him more exercise and you give him more engaging, entertaining things and he's still doing this, okay. If you run him every day at a time he can count on and he's totally exhausted when you're done and he still picks himself apart or he still digs the fence up, then maybe that really is an OCD issue. I don't know. Do you agree with this?
Well, I mean, I think you're definitely right that so many dogs live lives of just stultifying boredom. They are just bored out of their mind. We take these wonderful, sophisticated, complex animals who we designed in many ways to do amazing things, to go fetch things, to go to herd things, to dig after things, to catch things, to kill them even, like you talk about little terriers, man. Those dogs, that's what we've bred these dogs. We love them for that. And then we love them so much, but we bring them home and then we deprive them of all of these enriching activities that you've designed. And so, for sure, in some cases, I don't think there's anything to lose by giving a dog a life. Give them something to do. Give them the things that dogs love to do. They love to run. They love to sniff. Whatever it is your dog, you figure out what does your dog love.
Yeah, if it's a golden retriever chasing its tail, take it to the beach every day at the same time. Not just when it's sunny on the weekend sometimes. That dog needs to swim. Then try and see. Because if it still has all these issues, you may indeed need to follow through, just like we're talking about. And I think it's important to find that out first, though. Because, sometimes these problems are really just the people aren't giving the dog enough attention. Debbie, it's Debbie Jacobs we're talking to. I just want to make sure we get the title of your book out there. Can you give it to our listeners?
Well, I've got two books. One is called A Guide to Living With and Training a Fearful Dog, which is designed to help people get their head around how we work with fear-based behaviors in dogs. And then the latest is called Does My Dog Need Prozac?
And that's a great title.
And it is musings and sound advice on living with a shy, anxious, fearful, or reactive dog. And my website is called fearfuldogs.com. And that's where folks can get more information about them.
Okay, we don't have much time, but I'm wondering, do you think you could give us like a kind of bullet list for how to deal with separation anxiety?
Oh, well, I can do is I can steer you to a book. Get the book, Treating Separation Anxiety by Milena DeMartini Price. Separation Anxiety by Milena DeMartini Price. That because it really is, this is one of these challenges that, we can't really just, if we start throwing out tips and it deserves more than just let's throw things out there and see what works, because the sooner you get on to this, The sooner you're likely to, everybody's suffering in this, you know, people suffer because they can't leave the house or they come home to the house destroyed. The dog
Oh, they change their whole lives. I have some customers who literally they have to put their dog in daycare every time they go out. They just have no, the dog's 14 and they've been kind of kowtowing to him for 14 years. So they're not going to change the habit now and they're not willing now. That's the other thing. So I think it's really, really hard once the whole dynamic becomes entrenched for everybody.
Well, and isn't it nice that these people have found a way to help their dog? You know, I wouldn't call it kowtowing. I think that they've gone out of their way. They're willing to spend the money to do something. And maybe it's, you know, maybe it's not what a trainer would do, which is to take the time. It's a very challenging problem to work with. And I think if you're providing that service to people, that's a real, I mean, that is a gift to have a good daycare to somebody you trust to send your dog to so that you can go and live your life and not be stuck at home. And also, I mean, people are compassionate. We care. They love their dogs. They don't want to see their dogs suffer. So, you know, being able to offer that. But it is, it's a very challenging problem.
There are some dogs who come here, and we're primarily an overnight kennel and training and breeding and boarding. But there are some dogs who come here that have acute separation anxiety at home. But because of the dogs here, they don't. They don't even care that humans come and go. It's about not being completely alone. Now, that's not all of them. But is it not true that for some of these people, maybe getting a companion animal would help a lot?
It may. And again, you just said it. It depends on the dog. There are some dogs who are fine so long as there's another companion, whether it's a cat or a goat or another dog. There are some dogs, you know, or so long as it's another human. But for some of these dogs, it's a human. It's a very specific person. And so it depends.
Right.
You know, and it's certainly worth exploring it because we don't want to suggest somebody gets another dog and now they've got two dogs and it's not helping one. And you know,
but if they do have a chance to try it out and it works, I mean, what ends up happening is they not only rescued that dog and didn't have to rehome it and dump it back into the stream, but they actually took a cat too.
Win-win for us on our side. Yeah, it's a win-win. You go for that's a good one.
I think so. You know, get a really, really chill animal to keep it company. Get one that's like maybe on the fat side, maybe not too motivated about much, really happy, right? Really like a cat that just, it's a purr machine. Yeah, that's the cat, right? The calm dispenser. That's the way I'd go. Have you ever tried any of these pheromone diffusers for dogs with anxiety? I've tried it for cats and had cheap results.
I have, and I will say there is some science, there is some evidence to support the new, what they're calling the Adaptyl collar. So there is, you know, again, there is science to support that some dogs respond to it, but not all dogs. So again, it's sort of a caveat that if somebody wants to, there are some things that are worth trying along with whatever else we're doing, and then there are other things that are just save your money, don't waste your time. But the Adaptyl collar seems to be, given the research that was done on it, it has provided some data that indicates that it does provide some dogs with relief.
I've had good feedback from people about the Thunder Shirt and products like it. Have you also?
Again, the body wraps are, it's spotty information. One of the problems we have with the Thunder Shirt, and I've seen it happen, is that people do not identify calm, you know, as in I'm happy and I'm calm and I'm chill, with, oh my gosh, what is this? I'm not moving. Because the dog hasn't been, it's a scary thing that's happened to the dog. And I've seen dogs where you put the shirt on the dog, the dog says, oh my gosh, what is going on?
Why did they stick me in this thing?
Exactly. And the dog
I'm in trouble. I better stay still. Yeah, no, that's not the reaction you want. Okay, I understand you. Oh, we've run out of time. We only have a couple more minutes. Would you like to give out a website?
The website, easy for folks to find, fearfuldogs.com. You can find us on the web. You can find us on Facebook. We've got the fearfuldogs.com Facebook page, and we have a Fearful Dogs Facebook group where people get together and we share science-based modern professional dog training information for how to work with fear-based behaviors in dogs.
You know, I had a whole list to go through with you today. Three different types of separation anxiety. The old dog coming on Friday, where the people had just, you know, worked around it all these years. Another dog that never showed it until its owner moved house. And now it started. Mm-hmm. And the gas station guy. I got to the gas station guy. So could you come back on in the future sometime? Because I've got a page of questions for you.
Happy to.
Oh, that's Happy great. To. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Debbie.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Until next week, this has been Deborah Wolf. If you want to find me, go to DeborahWolfOnline.com and DeborahWolfe online.com. But you should know that by now. And I'll be back next week on Smart Animal Talk, All Paws Pet Talk Radio. Until then, be good to your animals. And anytime.